Well, good morning, everybody. Oh, you can say good morning louder than that, I'll bet you. Ah, love it, love it. He is risen, we should start with. My name is Ted Peters. I teach theology at Pacific Lutheran Seminary in the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Our topic for this morning is life beyond death. Despite all of the advances of medical science, as far as we know, the death rate is still 100%. We have a lot of thought, sometimes weird thoughts, about the whole subject of death. There was one fellow, and perhaps you've heard this guy at your local tavern, who was spouting off. He believes that whenever your number's up, your number is up. When it's your time to die, it's your time to die, and nothing is going to get in the way of your appointed destiny. And as he was making this rather forceful point, his friend leaned over and he said, "Wait a minute, if you believe so strongly that we're all fated to die at a given point in time, then why is it that you never fly in airplanes?" And he said, "Well, if I'm sitting in an airplane and the time for the pilot is up, I don't want to go with him." Well, I'd like to take a look at the question of life beyond death and tell you, under the section there called method, a couple of assumptions with which I work in trying to think about this area. Theology is my field. In theology, I understand to be thinking about God and related matters, and when you think about God, everything is a related matter. And it seems to me that if it is true that God be the creator of all things, then there really is no subject area, whether in science or the teachings of non-Christian religions or other philosophies, that if we find a truth there, this truth contributes in one way or another to our understanding of God and God's creation. There is no truth, it seems to me, that we should be afraid of. And so although our Bible is our primary norm and source for what we think about in terms of God, it is okay and often helpful to look at other sources, and to some degree we're going to do that this morning. We're going to ask what various theories and ideas about life beyond death are. A couple of more assumptions, I think. First of all, death and beyond is mysterious. I think that's important. But it's not so mysterious that we know absolutely nothing about it. At the very heart of our Christian faith lies the Easter resurrection of Jesus, and that means we have at least a point of departure for thinking about the subject. On the other hand, we don't want to err on the other side and have a travelogue eschatology, that is to say, to claim that we know everything about it and be able to spell it out in all detail, because I don't think that we have that much knowledge about the subject either. So our method is going to be this. We're going to take a look at a variety of different ideas and reports of experiences about life beyond death. We'll look at them side by side, and we'll do so in light of what the New Testament teaches. The first view or perspective or interpretation is what I'm going to call the modern secular or naturalistic view. And I think that if you could understand our modern Western culture as a system of thought, this is the view that is endemic to our way of thinking. According to naturalism, take that word apart, anytime you've got an ism, you've got a strong belief in something. Naturalism is the idea of nature elevated to the level of an ideology, elevated to the level of a philosophy of life. And according to naturalism, when you're dead, you're dead. Naturalism teaches that the natural world of cause and effect is all there is to reality. It is self-existent, it is self-explanatory, self-operating, self-directing, and that if you and I want more than what the world of nature can give us, then we're asking for too much. Our expectations are too high. Joseph Wood Crutch says, living is only a physiological process with only a physiological meaning. Let's not ask for more. Bertrand Russell, the great atheist from Great Britain, important philosopher in the 20th century and mathematician, draws out the implication of the when you're dead theory, namely that life in any big and cosmic sense is meaningless. All the labor of the ages, he writes, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius is destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruin. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. I think that Peggy Lee can sum up the philosophy, or at least the implications, of naturalism as she did in her song some 10 years ago. If you may remember, it was on the hit parade, "If That's All There Is, Then I'm Going to Go On Dancing." Nevertheless, throughout the story of human civilization, people have not accepted that that is all there is. They have not wanted to believe that when you're dead, you're dead. There has been and continues to be a widespread hope for life beyond death. I've got a couple of examples here. One of my favorites is the Gilgamesh epic, and I'll put in a little plug here for Chuck Mayer in tonight's Vespers service, is also going to talk about the Gilgamesh epic. This is a mythological story that comes to us from the ancient Middle East, originally written in Akkadian in the 3rd millennium BC, but we know it as the Babylonian creation myth. In this myth, there's a story about a guy by the name of Gilgamesh, who is the king of Uruk, U-R-U-K. And while Gilgamesh is a young man, post-teenage, perhaps in his young 20s, feeling all of the energy and excitement of life, he has a best friend whose name is Enkidu. And while Gilgamesh and Enkidu are out romping it up, and they get into the neighbor's cow pasture, and the neighbor's bull goes on a stampede, runs over Enkidu, and kills him. Gilgamesh is now looking at the death of his best friend Enkidu, and he feels not only remorse over the death of Enkidu, but he's confronted now with his own mortality. If Enkidu can die, I can die too. And the whole threat of non-being, the whole threat of death, penetrates the soul of Gilgamesh. So what Gilgamesh sets out to do now is to discover the secret of immortality. And so he begins to ask around if anybody knows how it is that we can attain immortality. And then he hears the story of a guy by the name of Utnapishtim. How would you like a name like that? Utnapishtim, so the people tell him, had previously been an ordinary human being like the rest of us, but then he became immortal. He joined the ranks of the gods in the heavens. And so Gilgamesh, and this dominates the story then, sets out to find Utnapishtim. Well, after many travels, he eventually does. And he asks Utnapishtim for the secret of immortality. Utnapishtim is reluctant to give it, but Mrs. Utnapishtim intervenes and says it would be a good idea to share the secret. And Utnapishtim says that the secret of immortality is found in a plant, and this plant grows at the bottom of the ocean, and if you get a hold of this plant and you eat it, then you will have life eternal. Gilgamesh listens carefully to the details. He goes to the top of a very high cliff. He ties rocks to his feet, puts a knife in his mouth, and he jumps off this cliff into the ocean. The rocks carry him to the bottom of the ocean, and sure enough, there is the plant that he's looking for, and it has it's very prickly and hurts, but his dedication is great. He grabs that plant, even though it is hurting his hand. Then with the knife, he cuts the ropes on the rocks, and his body returns to the surface. He swims to shore, and he now has in his hand the secret of immortality, and he's going to take it back home and give it to Enkidu and bring Enkidu back to life again. However, he's very tired from the ordeal. And so he sits down and he makes himself a little campfire and he's going to rest before continuing the journey. And as he falls asleep, a snake crawls into the camp, smells the sweet aroma of the plant, and eats it. Just as Gilgamesh awakes and teary-eyed sees the snake slithering off, and now the snake has immortality and the human race has denied it. And as you're probably aware, many people in the ancient world believe snakes to be immortal because they shed their dead skins and go on living. This and other similar myths give voice, I think, to the cry within the human heart that there be something more than simply when you're dead, you're dead. Andrew Greeley, sociologist, formerly with the University of Chicago, did some surveys on belief in immortality, and he said that in the U.S. that 73% of adult Americans believe there is such a thing as life after death. He also discovered, I thought was kind of interesting, that in England and Sweden, only 38% of the people believe in life beyond death. And I don't know what to make of that. I do know this, though, that at least people in Great Britain believe in ghosts. And we in America have a tendency to be skeptical about ghosts. I don't know if that would have something to do with it. At any rate, Greeley has this conclusion on the basis of his study. We are born with two incurable diseases, life, always fatal, and hope, never curable. The critical question is whether hope is revelation or deception. And I think that if we're going to be intellectually honest about our own Christian teachings, that we really want to know the answer to that question. Is the basis of our faith found in revelation or in deception? Now, I'm going to suggest that there are four possibilities, four different ways of understanding personal survival beyond death. I call them logical possibilities. I don't know if this exhausts the logical possibilities or not. One thing I can tell you is that there are at least four possibilities which have made their appearance in the history of the religions and philosophies of the world. Let's look at what I call number three first. The astral body. If you go back to ancient Egypt and the pyramids, and if you may recall, the pharaohs are buried in the pyramids, and accompanying them are all sorts of the accoutrements of ordinary daily life for a king, that is. Toys for children are there. The weapons for the guards, the luxurious goblets for drinking, etc. When the outline or profile of the human being is found on the wall in the hieroglyphics, there is a kind of shadow or a second profile that is associated with the primary one, and this in was the ancient Egyptians called the Ka, K-A. One German archaeologist called it a doppelganger, a second going with, a second being that goes with the first one. And it seems that the Egyptians were working with an idea that each of us has two parts. There's our physical body, and then there's this second being that has the same shape as our physical body, yet isn't subject to the material limitations. And so what lives on in the pyramid after you close it up with a corpse in it is the Ka of the king. And the Ka of the king enjoys the Ka's of all of the other physical objects that are in there. So that it's not exactly the toys and the goblets and the fine wines that the Ka of the king enjoys, but rather the Ka's of these things. And even, we're not sure whether the ancient Egyptians believed that everybody had a ka, at least originally, but in later times they did, so that there was a post-funeral practice wherein the family of a deceased person would go out to the grave and leave a loaf of bread for the corpse or the living ka to enjoy. And if you couldn't afford a loaf of bread, you could take a picture of a loaf of bread and put that on the grave too, so that there must be another world for the Egyptian parallel to ours that has form but is not subject to our own physical limitations. I think that's one way of conceiving of life beyond death, and to some extent in contemporary spiritualism, the whole notion of the astral body is probably more similar to the ancient Egyptian belief than to others. Let's look at number one, immortality of the soul. I have Plato and I have Hinduism down there. The ancient Greek word for soul was psyche, psyche, P-S-Y-C-H-E, comes into English in our word psychology. Psyche is the principle of life. It's the principle that animates things. To have life is to be ensouled, ensikos. To die, in Greek, is to be without a soul, to have your soul abandon you. And it's from the Greeks, and Plato in particular, that we get this idea of a separate and separate soul distinct from our body, yet is still the essence of our personality. The soul understood as some sort of invisible, non-material, spiritual essence of the human being that upon death is freed from the body to live an independent existence. And Plato, as did the Hindus, believed in metempsychosis, that is to say, that the psyche or the soul, upon leaving the body at death, travels through some sort of in-between state and then is reincarnated in another body at a later time. What the soul is dedicated to has a lot to do with your and my word mind. The soul is in the business of knowing things. Pure intellection was that that held the highest value for Socrates and for Plato. And the problem in life is that your and my body, bodies with its physical appetites, is constantly competing, taking our soul away from its primary task of going after enlightenment, of going after knowledge. I want to read you a small passage from Plato's work, The Phaedo. And in this drama, Socrates is about to take the cup of hemlock and to die. I keep thinking of Don Kirk's lectures. He says, you know, just a hemlock the size of a peanut will cause you to die in 20 minutes. Well, that's what Socrates must have experienced. At any rate, Socrates is about to die from drinking the hemlock, and his friends are coming. They say, oh, Socrates, we're going to miss you. It's just awful that you're going to die. And Socrates says, don't worry about it. Because when I die, my soul will be able to study pure philosophy unhindered from the desires of the body for good food and etc. Okay, Socrates is speaking. The body and its desires are the only cause of wars and factions and battles, for all wars arise for the sake of gaining money, and we are compelled to gain money for the sake of the body. We are slaves to its service. And so because of all these things, we have no leisure for philosophy. I keep telling my wife I want leisure for philosophy, and she says, mow the lawn. But the worst of all is that if we do get a bit of leisure and turn to philosophy, the body is constantly breaking in upon our studies and disturbing us with noise and confusion so that it prevents our beholding the truth. And in fact, we perceive that if we are ever to know anything absolutely, we must be free from the body and must behold the actual realities with the eye of the soul alone. When we are dead, we are likely to possess the wisdom which we desire and claim to be enamored of. But but not while we live. So Socrates is assuming, first of all, that the soul is separate from the body. Secondly, that the soul is essentially good, and that the source of evil in the world comes from the body. And that finally, death is a form of relief, release, liberation, and salvation, because then the soul is freed from the evils of this physical world. Now, in Hinduism, you have the movement from number one to number four there on my outline, from the separation of the body and the soul towards absorption into the infinite, which finally becomes full-blown in Buddhism. In this case, the soul goes from life to death and then is reborn, lives again, and dies. But the ultimate objective of the Hindu religion is to get off the wheel of death and rebirth, to stop being born again. I didn't mean that as a pun, but that comes out rather interestingly in light of recent revivalism. The infinite, the whole, the all, the totality of reality in Hindu doctrine is Atman, A-T-M-A-N. The Atman is the essence and the totality of all things, and your and my individual self, oh, I said that wrongly, didn't I? The totality of reality is Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N. Atman refers to the self. Now, you and I think of ourselves, because of our physical bodies and of our pluralistic world, we think of ourselves as being separate from one another and as separate from the totality of reality. The person who attains enlightenment or liberation in the Hindu scheme of things is one who penetrates through introspection and discovers the truth. And the truth is that my Atman, myself, is really at one with Brahman, the totality of reality. And the problem with dying and being reborn again is that we're constantly living in this world of ignorance, where the body is smothering us in a world of darkness. And so through the practice of yoga in Hinduism, we penetrate the world of darkness, the physical world, and try to attain the world of enlightenment, and then you're never born again. And finally, in Hinduism, you get the logical equation, everything equals nothing. For the self to attain full and complete salvation is for the self to cease to be a self and to be totally absorbed into the infinite ground of all things. Just 180 degrees opposite of everything we believe in the Western world. Now, what I think is interesting, if we take a look at these religious traditions and raise this question, and the import of this, I think, will appear in a couple of minutes. What happens between incarnations, especially in the Hindu or Buddhist scheme? You live, you die, and before you're reborn again, there's this in-between state. Now, there's a great passage I'm going to read you here from a Chinese Buddhist sutra in which the individual soul now is looking forward to being reborn, born again into the physical world. But note the concept of light. Remember thinking back to Socrates. Socrates wanted pure knowledge. And almost universally, I've never seen an exception, in all of the world's religions, light and knowledge are closely identified. That's what we even in English, the word enlightenment, is for the highest attainable knowledge. Okay. As the time of death approaches, he sees a bright light, and being unaccustomed to it at the time of his death, he is perplexed and confused. He sees all sorts of things, such as are seen in dreams, because his mind is confused. He sees his future father and mother making love. I think that's kind of neat. You're leaving this world and already getting ready to come back again. Now, from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is a Buddhist, ancient Buddhist book, this in-between state where the soul has left the present but has not yet been reborn is called the bardo state, B-A-R-D-O. In the bardo state, I'm quoting now, wherein all things are like the void and cloudless sky, and the naked, spotless intellect is like unto a transparent vacuum without circumference or center. At this moment, know thou thyself. I find that fascinating. What's the summary of Socrates' philosophy? If you probably learned it in school a dozen times, gnistheoton, know yourself. Know yourself how? Know yourself in the ecstasy of being totally unlimited, unbounded by the physical and finite world, okay? In the bardo state, where all things are like the void and cloudless sky, and the naked, spotless intellect is like unto a transparent vacuum without circumference or center, at this moment know thou thyself, now thou art experiencing the radiance of the clear light of pure reality. Death here is the door to a kind of liberation and freedom and spiritual ecstasy. Now, I say that as a kind of prelude to what has become very important in the minds of many in the mid-1970s. For lack of a better name, I'll call it the life-after-life phenomena. A number of widely read books were published, and speakers making the TV talk shows and lecture circuits, the most prominent of which was probably Raymond A. Moody, who, as I understand it, is no longer engaged in such things, a combination physician and philosopher who concentrated on experiences, interviews of experiences of people who claim to have died and come back to life again. In fact, there were three different types of people that he interviewed, and listen carefully to these different types. One, he interviewed people who had died, that is to say, had been pronounced victims of clinical death, but who were resuscitated. And I mean, I've asked physicians about this. I mean, does this really happen? Yes, it really happens. You can be, for all practical purposes, dead on the operating table, and then a short period later, return again to life. One physician in Syracuse that I talked to said that it's not impossible to be dead for 20 minutes. Secondly, the second group of people that he interviewed were people who came very close to dying, did not die, and remained alive. The third group is those people who actually did die, but who in the process of dying at the very last moment or two were talking with somebody else, and so second-handedly we can find out what they had to say. Then the actual description of the life beyond life of experience seems to be the same for all three groups of people. Now, let me read to you a first-hand account of one of the interviews from the Moody book. Has anybody here read at least one of Moody's books on this? Yeah, a fair number. They were widely read in the 70s. Very fascinating accounts, and I've personally been able to talk with a couple of people whose experiences fit the pattern that Moody describes. Okay. I heard the doctors say that I was dead. Jeez. This lady's on the operating table. I heard the doctors say that I was dead, and that's when I began to feel as though this blackness, which was some kind of enclosure, there are not really words to describe this. Everything was very black, except that way off from me I could see this light. It was a very, very brilliant light, but not too large at first. It grew larger as I came nearer and nearer to it. I was trying to get to that light at the end because I felt that it was Christ, and I was trying to reach that point. It was not a frightening experience. It was more or less a pleasant thing. For immediately, being a Christian, I had connected the light with Christ, who said, "I am the light of the world." I said to myself, "If this is it, if I am to die, then I know who waits for me at the end. there in that light. Another commentator on the life after life phenomenon is a fellow by the name of Ralph Wilkerson, who is formerly president of Melodyland Seminary, which is a charismatic school, and he produced a book. I think the name of it was Beyond and Back. The Mormons went and produced a movie using this title, but the movie that the Mormons produced was not exactly the same thing as the book. The Mormons, if you saw that movie, had an experience in a hospital where they weighed a person before and after he died, and the soul weighed 4 ounces. You don't find any of that in Wilkerson. Wilkerson tries to extract from these accounts 5 common denominators. A person who experiences a life beyond life experience, 1, floats over his or her body, out of the body experience, OBE. 2, they travel through a dark tunnel. 3, they see a bright light. 4, they hear buzzing noises. Now, I'm curious about that one because I did not see the buzzing noise business as very widespread at all. But that's in Wilkerson's list. 5, they see departed loved ones. After a person has had a life beyond life experience, Wilkerson says, and in just the couple of people with whom I've spoken, this seems to be borne out. The person comes back with a new set of values, and there are 3 features of this new set of values. First, the person usually says, live for today. Do not put off till tomorrow things that you believe to be important. Secondly, they say that materialism is no longer an obsession. They're no longer materialists. They're no longer caught up or preoccupied with the things of the physical world, with the attaining of wealth and comfort, etc. Third, they're no longer afraid of death. They've been there and come back, and they say that they're not afraid of it anymore. It seems to me that if we're going to take this contemporary experience of the 1970s and look for precedents in the back in time, that what's being described here comes closest to what we found in Plato and to a lesser extent in Buddhism. There's almost a disdain, not quite, but almost a disdain for the physical and the material world. Not quite, but bordering on a sense of understanding the physical or the material world as a prison for the soul which belongs elsewhere. Now, when Moody, in his book, what was the name of it again? Life After Life. In his book, Life After Life, he begins to speculate a little bit, trying to get a handle of this phenomenon. And it's a well-written book, I think, in the sense that he tries to give you the observational data before he ventures in to theorize about it. But when he does begin to theorize, he does not use the phrase immortality of the soul. Rather, he goes to the Bible and he borrows from St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, the idea of a spiritual body. At first, I didn't like that. I'm saying to myself, Moody, you're doing this wrong because the actual accounts look more like Plato. Does not look like St. Paul. On the other hand, looking at it a little bit more closely, and you look at the reports of, say, someone dying on the operating table, and then they have an out-of-the-body experience. They're observing what's going on. Or in a couple of cases where I've personally interviewed people, they seem to sense that when they're out of their body, they have a physical form. I'm reminded much more of the Egyptian Ka than I am either of Plato's immortal soul or of St. Paul's spiritual body. And I'll get back to St. Paul and the spiritual body in a little bit. I think the jury is still out in terms of understanding what it is that Moody is reporting on the life after life experiences. Let me tell you a little story from my own ministry, which has a tendency for me to keep the jury out. While I was serving a parish in New Orleans, the janitor and his wife, who were very active members in the congregation, asked me if I wouldn't call on the janitor's sister-in-law in the hospital. She didn't come to our church. She didn't go to any church. Hadn't gone to any church for her entire life. And he warned me that she was awfully hard to get along with. And that was an understatement. She was probably the most grouchy, cantankerous woman that I have ever confronted. But I was highly motivated to visit her because I was asked to do it as a favor for Henry. And so I kept going back again and again, and eventually was able to be invited into her room, and we had some awfully good conversations. Now, she had been married to Henry's brother for 40 years. They had never had any children. They had never had any friends. It was obvious why. And these two people had loved each other very much. And as far as I could see, they had only one another. They didn't have much of a life beyond one another. And Henry's brother had died 1 year earlier. Now, she's in the hospital. Let me tell you why she's in the hospital. She was out pruning her roses, and a rose thorn pricked her finger. And she didn't put methylate or a bandage on it. And eventually that finger got infected, and she still did nothing about it. Her arm got infected. Gangrene sent in. So by the time Henry takes her to the hospital, she's in for an amputation. Anybody want to suggest what's going on with her psychologically? What does she want? She wants to die. To me, it was quite obvious, even though she didn't say so. In addition to that, she did have two German shepherds, which you'd expect, right? And the neighbors had called the police, and her German shepherds had been taken away in addition. Now, she says... as soon as she can, following the operation, her arm is now gone. The doctors have said it's not healing. They can't understand. Her arm is not healing. She says to me on one visit, she says, you know, I have this dream. I want to tell you about this dream. She says, I have it again and again. She says, I dream that I'm going through this long, dark tunnel. And at the far end of this tunnel, there's this little speck of light. But the further I get through the tunnel, the bigger the light gets. And soon I see a silhouette in the tunnel. And I get closer, and I realize it's Henry's silhouette. And Henry is waving to me to come on through. And she says, and I go towards the light, and then something pulls me back. She says, I have this dream every night. What the reality of the life after life experiences are, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that the symbols, the form for understanding a certain operation within the human soul, are available at various levels of consciousness. You can find it in the myths, the works of the philosophers, the poets, in dreams, as well as those people who claim personally to have had these very unusual experiences.
You find that experience in 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul talks about having known someone, whether in the body or out of the body, ascended to the third heaven and saw things which cannot be seen or heard.
I had never thought of that particular passage in this context. That's
a person in the present tense. I know a man 13 years ago. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, only God knows. And ascended to the third heaven. Saw things which cannot be seen.
Yeah, I had, when dealing with that particular passage, I had thought of that in terms of a different genre, in terms of the general religious experience, the sense of ecstasy that one has in the moment of revelation. These kinds of experiences, although close to revelation, are usually not that. St. Paul had one other ecstatic experience that was very important, and that was the Damascus Road.
But that's the assumption that Paul is talking of himself in 2 Corinthians 12.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't say he's talking of himself, that's assumed. We take it literally that he's not talking about himself, that he knows a man other than himself, then he may be talking about it.
Oh, I see, that perhaps he had interrogated someone with this experience.
Well, or visited with someone, or someone told him of this experience.
Yeah, but you are right. We always assume that he's referring to himself in the third person, though.
He doesn't say that.
Yeah. Well, that would be an interesting one to speculate on. That's a good question. But it seems to me there's so much more to a religious experience in general that the out-of-the-body experiences we only have a part of.
Yeah, I don't believe he's talking about a religious static experience, but an out-of-the-body experience that someone has shared with him.
Yeah. Could be. In general, my thesis with which I would like to work is that we ought to pursue the study of such claims and such experiences with an open and scientific mind, scientific in the best sense of the word of open, and let the actual evidence determine our judgment. I am going to suggest that we don't have a dogma, a Christian dogma, on this particular point. We as Christians, however, do have some teachings that relate to the question of death and beyond, and one of the motivations I have for dealing with the whole subject area is that I think there's been some confusion, especially due to the excitement in the last 10 years over the life-after-life phenomenon, and I'd like at minimum to point out where that confusion may lie and how it is that we should think our way through it. Just briefly, about Jewish apocalypticism, I want to say this. That in Jewish apocalypticism, life beyond death is closely related to justice. By Jewish apocalypticism, I'm referring to that kind of thinking that was going on probably for one, if not two centuries prior to the time of Jesus. A form of thinking that gives it comes to expression in books such as the Book of Revelation, wherein death and suffering in this world is met with teachings about resurrection and God's judgment and God's reward. The Jews, just prior to 165 BC, were suffering tremendously under the Greek satraps. Antiochus Epiphanes IV, in particular, was putting extreme pressure upon the Jews to conform to Hellenistic culture. He sacrificed a pig on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem, even erected a temple, a statue of Zeus in the temple in order to stamp out the Jewish religion. Should you remain faithful to God, not only might you suffer social discrimination, you might even suffer death. At this particular point, apocalyptic literature appears, and one of the most prominent elements in it is resurrection of the dead. If you are faithful to God, if you do everything right, your chances of suffering for it are great. If you deny God, your chances of making it in society are great. So that there's no intrinsic reward for having faith in God. The doctrine of the resurrection function as a vindication for your faithfulness. God is not undone by your death. And that justice, the principles of justice, the confidence that our God is a just God, yielded this sense that God will vindicate the righteous even beyond the grave. That is in part of the background, the framework, the furniture of the intellectual world when Jesus makes his appearance. Death. How does the Bible view death? I think that death is understood in the Bible primarily as that which puts an end to evil. Not totally different from that of Socrates, but still with a somewhat different accent. If you go back to the Garden of Eden, and Adam and Eve eating the fruit. If you may remember, there were two trees in the Garden of Eden. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil was the one that we most often think of. That had the tree with the forbidden fruit. That had the tree that Adam and Eve ate and precipitated God's throwing them out of the garden. Now, why does God throw them out of the garden? Is it because he's so ticked off over having disobeyed his orders? Is he just so angry now that he's going to punish them? I mean, there's a certain element in there, but that element is obviated by, I think it's the closing verses of chapter 3, or maybe chapter 4, I can't remember in Genesis, where God puts an angel with a fiery sword at the gate of the Garden of Eden so they can't get back in. Why? Because of the other tree. The other tree is the tree of life. Had Adam and Eve eaten from the tree of life, which they didn't do, then they would have lived forever in their sin. Keeping Adam and Eve away from the tree of life, the Bible is saying that sin and its evil repercussions will not go on forever. There will be an end to it. And that already, and the fact that God loves Adam and Eve is also found in a very subtle passage. As they're leaving the garden, he notices that their fig leaves are drying up. And so God makes for them aprons of leather. In other words, there is this gesture of continuing providential caring for Adam and Eve. So throwing them out of the garden is primarily so that death will finally bring an end to evil.
Ted, there also seems to be a strong tradition of death as the final work of evil.
Death is the final work, the wages of sin, etc.
The cosmic struggle in Apocalyptic and New Testament, that the death is the ultimate tool of the devil.
Well, and I think that certainly makes more forceful the Good Friday thing. That Jesus' death, we sometimes like to think it may be the work of God, but there's another way to look at it, too. It's the final triumph of all of the forces of evil.
Is that the driving them out of the garden, then, the very first act of salvation?
Well, I would see it as an act of grace, yes. That death can be understood as an act of grace. And if you understand God's grace as something that has to work its way out in history, I mean, it would be an act of God's grace that is leading somewhere. It's not exactly the same thing as salvation, if you want to think of salvation as the end product. But
it's the beginning of salvation.
It is the beginning of salvation, that's right. The resurrection of Jesus and these comments that you've just made are very important, I think, to keep this framework of evil and death as the end of evil in mind as we think of Jesus' crucifixion. Jesus really dies. I see no evidence in the New Testament that Jesus has an immortal soul that slips off into the world of pure intellection. There's a big difference between the way Jesus dies and the way Socrates dies. Socrates can die in comfort, even telling his friends, "Don't worry, it's going to be better for me." Jesus, in sharp contrast, is facing almost what the naturalist says, the snuffing out of his entire life. Jesus, before his own death, prays and sweats drops of blood. He says in his Gethsemane prayer, "Dear God, let this cup pass from me." And it seems to me there's no question as to what that cup refers to. That's Socrates' cup of hemlock. It's the cup of death. It's not the communion cup, necessarily. "Let this cup pass from me. I don't want to do it." That's the way he begins his prayer. He concludes his prayer, if you may remember, "Not my will, but thy will be done." This tremendous struggle. So that death for Jesus is far more terrifying than it was for Socrates. Jesus wasn't operating with an astral body or an immortal soul. In general, and this is a very important difference, I think, between the way the Bible looks at the nature of the human being and other philosophies of the world. We believe that evil and sin cuts so deeply that it cuts all the way into the human soul. Remember, the Greeks could assume that the soul is good and the body is evil. If we're going to think in terms of body and soul, then evil cuts so deeply that the soul itself is just as evil as is the body. We have to deal with people as total units and not sliced up, so to speak, between a good part and an evil part. Now, the resurrection of Jesus, which occurs on Easter, is not his, like I say, slipping off into the world of pure intellection or his soul being reincarnated again. Jesus' resurrection is not a return to life in the ordinary sense of the word. And in order to make that point clear, I think in the New Testament there are other incidences of people coming back to life which are similar to but clearly different from Jesus. There are three important ones. There's the widow's son at Nain in the Gospel of Luke. If you may remember, Jesus comes to the city of Nain. There is this young man laid out on the stretcher. He's dead. And his widow is weeping. And Jesus apparently sizes up the situation. You know, they didn't have Social Security then. And the widow doesn't have any way to support herself. So she, not only is she losing a beloved son, but source of economic support. Jesus raises the son back to life again. He takes his mother home, takes good care of her. The Jairus' daughter, the 12-year-old girl, if you may remember, Jesus has this little dialogue with all the wailers. What do you mean dead? She's only sleeping. And then they laugh at him. He raises her from the dead. Then Lazarus in the Gospel of John, dead for 3 days. No doubt about it. There's no swooning here. Lazarus comes forth. But in all three cases, these people are going to have to die again. They return to a normal life. They're going to have to tie their shoes in the morning, and they're going to have to eat their meals all day long, and they're going to have to work, grow old, and die a second time. Not so when Jesus is raised. Jesus is raised to eternal life. And when people see the risen Jesus, they don't ask him to come back and perform his ordinary tasks, such as supporting his mother again. No, when they see Jesus, they say, "Behold the Lord." Because Jesus represents the final consummation of all things, the appointed destiny, the resurrection of the dead that the apocalypticists had been thinking about already. Just a quick footnote for a science fiction novel. I don't know if you've read Miller's Canticle for Leibowitz. Anybody ever read that? It's a great sci-fi novel, and there's this crotchety character in it who keeps appearing. For 1,500 years, he keeps appearing again and again, and he's always angry at something. Not till the end of the book do you find out who he is. He's Lazarus. Jesus raised him from the dead, and now he can't die again. He really wants to die because the world is so miserable, and he has to keep going on watching the misery without end. Okay, now, how are we to understand the resurrection of Jesus? I think we get more understanding out of 1 Corinthians 15 than any other point. The actual topic for 1 Corinthians 15 is your and my resurrection from the dead in the writings of St. Paul. But I believe that we can look at Jesus and ourselves together here because St. Paul says in verse 20 of that chapter, Christ is the first fruits of those having fallen asleep. And he deliberately wants to identify the resurrection of Jesus on Easter with your and my resurrection at the coming of the kingdom. Now, St. Paul doesn't have a ready-made philosophy, it seems to me. He doesn't have a carefully thought-out view of things. Plato was far more thorough in laying out his theory than St. Paul, but I think St. Paul does know what it is he's against and what it is that he's for. He says, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Whatever the resurrection into the kingdom of God is, it's not ordinary life as we know it now. What he's talking about in the resurrection of the body isn't a return to ordinary life, but some sort of transformation. A transformation that is roughly the equivalent of the creation of the world at the beginning. So let me read to you the paragraph, beginning with verses 42 forward, and you can notice the terms, the key contrasts that I've got listed there on the yellow sheet. So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown perishable is raised imperishable. What is sown in dishonor is raised in glory. What is sown in weakness is raised in power. It is sown a physical body, it is raised a spiritual body. And I think that phrase spiritual body is close to being a metaphor. It's close to being a contradiction. If we think back now, the New Testament, St. Paul is using the same language that Socrates used. A spiritual body with that sharp contrast between the physical and the superphysical, Paul is talking about a spiritual body. Perhaps a Greek reading that might say, hey, this is nonsense. And that they believed it was nonsense is clear from the story in the book of Acts where St. Paul goes to preach in Athens, if you may remember, and they're listening very carefully to all the wise things that St. Paul is saying, and then he gets to the resurrection of the body, and they say, ah, phooey, what's a bunch of baloney, and they all walk away. They're not going to buy that. So that a soma pneumatikon, a spiritual body, must have just, nope, that's not the way it works. So St. Paul is talking about your and my, not survival, but transformation into the kingdom. What he's ruling out, I think, is being absorbed into the infinite, because our self, our personhood, is going to pass through the veil. He's ruling out resuscitation of a corpse, because we're being raised to an imperishable, incorrupt life. He's ruling out total annihilation. He doesn't believe, as the naturalists do, when you're dead, you're dead. Our individuality, our personhood, is going to be present in God's kingdom. We are going to share in God's kingdom a resurrection that is analogous to that of Jesus on Easter. One concluding remark, or at least a point of departure. The problem is, what is the relationship between what the New Testament is projecting then about God and God's full accomplishment, your and my promised resurrection on the one hand, and the reports of out-of-the-body experiences on the other? God delivered to us a revelation in Scripture, I think, that says a lot about our ultimate future, about God's consummate fulfillment of all things, and I believe the resurrection of Jesus and the promise of 1 Corinthians 15 has to do with that. With regard to questions such as ghosts, out-of-the-body experiences, and this kind of thing, I have my opinions, you probably have your opinions. But it seems to me that we ought to study this matter with an open mind and try and evaluate it on the basis of the evidence. Because it's clear to me that when these experiences are reported, they're simply extensions of this worldly experiences in one form or another. That even a ghostly existence in which you kind of hover around the home in which you grew up is not heaven. It's not everything that the creation was meant to be by any stretch of the imagination. Finally, how should we die? I think it's just fine for us to indulge in, meditate, and think about understandings of death that do not come strictly from the Christian tradition, as long as they contribute to the teaching of comfort, which I believe that we get from what we understand Jesus' resurrection to be. I like, in particular, William Cullen Bryant's poem, Thanatopsis, which, it speaks for itself. Let me give you the concluding lines. So live, that when thy summons comes to join the innumerable caravan which moves to that mysterious realm where each shall take his chamber in the silent halls of death, thou go not, like the quarry slave at night, scourged to his dungeon, but, sustained and soothed by an unfaltering trust, approach thy grave like one who wraps the drapery of his couch about him and lies down to pleasant dreams. Thank you for your attention. I think we've got very little time left. Are we over? But let's have a...
You mentioned that Moody isn't into this anymore. Does he deny or belittle his findings, or what is his position?
I don't think he denies or belittles his findings. It is my understanding that later on in his research, he fully embraced the Christian faith. Then somewhere after that, and I don't know this for detail, maybe in detail, maybe some of you know it better, I think he felt that there were a large number of unanswered questions and that he wasn't really any closer to all of the answers than he had been when he had started, and that unless there was going to be an advance in the science, he wasn't going to pursue it any further. That was my understanding of the mood. And I don't think he stopped completely. He's just no longer on the lecture circuit or pursuing the research in a direct way. I think that happens with a lot of subjects, that you get so far and you don't see any progress in your understanding, and then you just wonder if you should continue gathering the same data, the new instances, the same data over and over. Yeah.
That the Christian faith seems to be expressed, as I listen to lay people in my congregation, that when we die, my soul goes to heaven. And they use Moody's research to support that,
yes,
that thesis. And then I look at the Apostles' Creed, and we believe in the resurrection of the body. And the Christian faith historically seems to be saying that when we die, we're dead, to be raised up at the end of time. Would you speak to that?
Yeah, that's part of the confusion that I'm concerned about. The idea of our soul dying and going to heaven has filtered into our religious tradition from external sources. That was not there in Jesus' experience. St. Paul doesn't teach it in any vivid way. Certainly it belongs to the Greek language and it belongs to the culture in which the Bible appeared, but that's not at the heart of our teaching. And I think, Jesus kept warning us, don't build your house on sand. And there's a sense in which if we all of a sudden put a whole lot of hope in Moody's research, you know, in 10 years from now we can come along and show that there's something wrong with it, we'll have built our house on sand. And the heart and the center of our Christian teaching is the resurrection of Jesus. As enigmatic as that may seem relative to other philosophies and religious points of view. Yes, I would speak to that in the sense that I don't want Christian teaching confused with some very interesting and exciting research about out-of-the-body experiences.
Just to follow that up, when giving that sort of an answer in one of my classes, the question came back, then what do you do with Jesus saying to the sinner today, you should be in paradise?
Oh, that's a biggie. I get that one exegetically all the time.
Paradise is not heaven.
Paradise is not heaven. Tell me what you mean.
Well, in the Old Testament, Sheol and paradise and the pit are not end places, but intermediate places. And I don't mean intermediate in the terms of purgatory.
Extrapolating on that, in the medieval Roman Catholic Church, from which many of our beliefs come, there was quite a mixture of purely biblical teachings on the one hand and all kinds of other teachings on the other. And St. Thomas worked this out rather well, that your soul separates from the body and goes off to heaven now. But then, of course, we have to look forward to the consummation of nature and history, and on the day of judgment, then the soul and the body come back together again. So in a single system, you could have the whole works. And I'm not so sure that's all that bad.
Except that by the time of Jesus, paradise is merely another name for the abode of the dead.
Paradise...
Not necessarily in place
beyond that. Well, the number of different uses of paradise. Paradise is initially the Garden of Eden before the fall. And then in some of the mythical thinking, heaven is a return to paradise. Well, in the long run, the kingdom of God, as I understand it, in Jesus and St. Paul, is not a return to the Garden of Eden at all. It's a new advent. In fact, to avoid the ambiguity, I've tried to get myself into the habit of using the term the kingdom of God, which is interchangeable in the Gospel of Matthew with Kingdom of Heaven, in order to refer to that new reality which God has promised for all of creation. And it's found not in space, not in going upstairs from earth to heaven upstairs. It's found rather in time when God draws to a conclusion everything that he set out to do. Kingdom of God avoids some of that ambiguity, but on the other hand, it's not something entirely different from heaven either.
In trying to talk about life after death, where does Ruach fit in as the breath of God through life?
It'll be a long discussion.
That fits into the discussion.
Well, you'd have to work through the whole notion of the Holy Spirit, I think, in terms of working that one through. We'll try it, though.
I just happened to read an excerpt.